Welcome to the podcast Tourism from Zero, where we bring you stories about interesting tourism stakeholders in your country. My name is Rudy Medved, and I am accompanied by guests who share their exciting tourism experiences of how they move tourism from zero to hero. This is the third aired special episode, where Miha Bratec and I talk to Dr. Karina Ren, an associate professor at Aalborg University, Copenhagen. Karina gave us insights into the sphere of tourism development in the Arctic and how several realities affect it. On the one hand, there is a more niche and alternative tourism. On the other hand, there are purely economic mass tourism needs. The question we are trying to answer is how to find a balance between the different tourism-related needs that different parts of human society have. Hello, Karina. Nice to meet you.
Hello, Rudy. Nice to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
That's great. Thank you for responding so quickly to our interview. And this is our third aired special episode, so I'm really excited. And for starters, I would just like to ask you to introduce yourself a little bit. Tell us a little bit about you.
Yeah. So, I'm just going to switch off this annoying thing here in the background. Yes. Yeah, so, hi, my name is Karina Ren, and I'm an associate professor at the University of Aalborg in Denmark. And I'm working on our campus in Copenhagen. Where I'm from. I'm an associate professor in tourism and cultural innovation. And I teach on our international master's program in tourism. I am originally an ethnologist, but I have a PhD from the University of Southern Denmark in tourism and intercultural communication. So that's a little bit about my work. And I should also mention that I've also recently taken on a position as the head of something called AU Arctic, which is the Arctic platform of our university. Because as I'll get back to, I've worked I do work with tourism development in the Arctic regions.
Very interesting. Very nice background. Culture, tourism, Arctic mixed well.
Yeah.
A bit of communication, a bit of gastronomy, a bit of place branding, and a bit of collaboration. No, that's how I would sum up your academic career. Would that be correct, Karina?
Well, it's interesting that you say sum up. So my colleagues often tease me because I have what they sometimes refer to as 1,000 legs, small legs. Because I always, when we have a conversation, I have a little leg in that area. So maybe that's my strength and weakness, that I'm interested in many, many things in and around the tourism. And so I tend, and also because I love collaborating, I end up, I find myself in many different conversations and areas of study. So, but I think that what you said sums it up pretty well.
Yeah, I can totally understand you because I'm also going into different directions, and this can be a strength and a weakness because you don't have the clear, let's say, career path. Then, no.
Yeah,
and you're a little bit of this and a little bit of that. You can basically hold whatever conversation, but you are. Then people would soon accuse you that you are not an expert in anything. No.
At least I will never be that type of researcher that has studied something. Besides if you talk about tourism, but having studied something in great detail for decades.
I guess if you are like a naturally curious person, it's actually easy. It's not easy to stay focused on just one area.
And I think it ties into maybe also what is an academic. And I find myself, I think, lucky that I am an academic now and maybe not one 20 or 30 years ago, where an academic was, or being an academic was perhaps a more solitude position. I think being collaborative by nature, being that is more welcomed in, and I think in our modern university, that you can collaborate, that you're able to, and also, I mean, that you can travel if we look apart from this recent times, that you can just collaborate on knowledge on so many different levels at the moment.
Cool. So you have, I assume you also have the tendency to get involved with too many things at once.
It happens. Correct. it's been known to have happened. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Learning how to say no is like a process, a long
yes,
one.
Yes.
I think we will slowly master it. And I just wanted to ask you in this like sort of direction, how did you get involved with AIR?
Well, I think AIR is probably like such a good example of this. So I think it actually started with you, Miha, didn't it?
Probably somehow. Yes. Yeah.
it's strange to think, but I mean, is it like 15 years ago? I was maybe a little less. I was your teacher at the University of Southern Denmark.
My first ever course I took in tourism.
Yes, strategic communication.
Exactly.
Probably it was like the first course I ever taught. So but first
you course. Did well. You did well. We didn't notice.
And so did, like, and
you,
so
know,
did you.
We didn't
and
notice so that you were so fresh.
and so years later, when I found myself at Aalborg University, we were organizing an innovation camp, which was something that we had with our students back at the time. So taking them out in a real life environment to grapple with issues and challenges that stakeholders met at destination level. And so I can't remember the details of it, but somehow we found ourselves connected to you and later on also Dejan, Krishar, and went with our students on a fantastic travel to Slovenia at different destinations. Our students learned a lot, and so did we as the teacher staff, and I think then continued this conversation about innovation and tourism with you and with Dejan, who then after a few years I think contacted us about the plans to form EF. So this is how it all started. Yeah, the beginning of a beautiful friendship, as you say.
Nice. Yeah. We hopefully we'll be able to repeat some sort of work camp soon, no?
Yes, yes, yeah.
I think we are all ready for it, to immerse ourselves on some student project, go somewhere and research and see how things changed in the last few years.
You said it. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And you also had quite some friends that are also part of the AIR, no? Because in the previous episode, we interviewed Gunnar from Iceland.
Yes.
And you two have a history as well, no? Also prior to AIR.
Yes. So, I mean, I think Gunnar and also now retired René van der Doem from the Wageningen University in the Netherlands, we think of ourselves as the three musketeers, having worked extensively on actor network theory and basically also positioning more than human actors and materiality more into tourism. So the three of us have written our PhD dissertations at about the same time and found out that we needed to collaborate more because of our joint interests. And since then, so this is also more than a decade now, we've co-edited a number of books and research articles, and Gunnar and I now continue our conversations. I mean, I spoke to him this morning, so work together. We've published and talked and thought together quite a lot over the years.
Nice. So that let's say it's big, one big family growing, you know, the AIR kind of.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think that's really this idea of how it's grown from below, this bottom up kind of organic process of of collaborating and being interested. And there's not one project. It's not, you know, like a 3-year project, or it's not, it doesn't have fixed boundaries or an end result, but kind of like this this ecosystem of different associates that opt in or out, or new come and others leave for other projects, and maybe you're in at, you know, with certain issues, or, you know, with certain resource or capacity at one moment, and then, you know, things change. So I really like this idea of thinking it almost like organically as this this ecosystem of associates.
Yeah, that's a nice description, actually. Yeah, because we think, okay, we circulate some emails among each other, we get an idea, then one invites the other for some new projects, and things open up, no? And then at certain point, it's a circle, you again meet the person you previously worked with like a few years ago.
Yes, and I think that's why, I mean, it's a good way of thinking about it, also in terms of like good research karma, right? Like, how are you a good research buddy? And how do you maintain trust and good collaborations throughout the years? Where I think, unfortunately, in many other ways of organizing tourism research, it's very project based, and it has like a beginning and an end. But I think thinking more about these long term, I wouldn't say deeper. They're not necessarily deeper. They just have an open character where you can contribute and get things back in return, but on a longer basis. And I think about this as kind of a karma thing, that you want to be a good colleague. You cannot be everything to everyone always, exactly. But you can be, you know, like the Bob Marley song. you can be something to some people at some times. Yeah.
A really like interesting perspective, and like, okay, with some people you really have like very, very like common research methodologies or theories that you're dealing with others you're completely on the opposite spectrum, but then you find ways on how to kind of interact with each other, no?
Yes, yeah.
And involving all the time also like students and the real life, so the industry or the like stakeholders from the tourism development side.
Yes.
And we tried to define it with Gunnar, and we didn't really succeed. How would you say, what can network actor theory, no? Or actor network theory?
Actor network theory.
How would you describe it in a very simple words to someone who is operating in tourism? What can it offer to him? Let's say that we have a small tourism entrepreneur in the rural setting somewhere, either in Denmark or Slovenia, let's say European context, no? What can this theory kind of explain to him, or which insights can it give to him?
Yeah, well, I think that I mean, it's always quite difficult to boil down complex theories, but
exactly.
I think at the heart of this is the idea that tourism, because this theory is all about relations and how we create each other, if you will, in relation. So what does this mean? Well, it means that tourism is not a closed system. Tourism is related to other spheres of the social in so many ways, which practitioners will be very well aware of. But I think often, and also that materiality matters, whether you have a passport or not, whether you have a landing strip or not, or whether you have a road or a train rail rather than a landing strip, whether you use certain products rather than others, whether you use digital technology or not. Like, these things matter in how you're able to create a business. So how does relating to others, seeing tourism as linked to other social issues and how materiality matters. I think that is, I wouldn't even say that this is something ANT shows to practitioners. I think maybe it's the reverse, that scholars need to think about, look at how tourism entrepreneurs and businesses operate and how very often they tie things together, which in theory and even in policy and even in the way that laws and funding schemes, etc., are composed, like they make distinctions between what is tourism and what is not tourism, or when are you actually a tourism entrepreneur, or when are you actually a farmer, for instance, right? But people that work in farm tourism don't make those distinctions.
Oh, they are both. No, it's part of their life.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And I think also working with these relations and also multiplicity, that you can be many things at once, mm-hmm. and that tourism can be many things at the same time. We don't need to pin down what it is, but rather to be able to navigate in this complexity and this multiplicity, that things are many things at the same time. So ANT shows that, you can say, to practitioners, but I think actually it's the other way around, that practitioners do that. They operate in these complex, multiple realities, and that we as tourism researchers just need to be much better at showing that. And why? Because as I was saying, like often the way that laws and policies and funding schemes are created, they still operate in a very, what should I call it, silo-like world, where things are separate. Yeah. Where you can only be a farmer or only be a tourism business.
Exactly. It's very sectorial, no? And you get into put into one drawer and you cannot like move to another.
Yeah. And I think many of the controversies and the friction that you work with on a daily basis as a tourism stakeholder partake to this this fact that tourism is often siloed in policy, in governance, in funding, and in different ways. Yeah. So, and I think that needs to change.
Okay. Yeah. I fully agree. I think one of the main problematics of tourism and of whole destination management is policy making. No, and if we So another assumption I am like making for myself now listening to you, rationalizing over NAT, perhaps it's the biggest value is that basically by observing the entrepreneurs, us academics could provide better answers with the help of NAT to the policymakers. Would that make sense?
Yes, I mean, one of the critiques that NAT has received over the years is how it's kind of it's descriptive as opposed to prescriptive or normative way of working. Like the ANT is basically like the methodology of ANT is like follow the actor. Mm-hmm. So or you could say it in a more mundane way, like follow the action.
Follow the action.
Put yourself in the midst of things. Mm-hmm. Go where you can see that there is tension, friction, controversy, where certain things are happening or certain concerns are being manifested, and try to describe in quite a deep and precise or detailed manner what is it that's happening, what is it that we're seeing, and not limiting ourselves to saying we're only going to look at the structures or we're only going to be looking at certain things. So try to get all actors, whether they are human, so is it operators, businesses, or is it also something about these products, like food products, or something about digital connectivity, or is it something about different kinds of policies, or is it about different? So where's the trouble? Let's follow the actors where they go and what they do and what different props or different different devices or things they use to do what they need to do or to contest something they do not want to do. So I think that here the non-human component is actually helping for us to get this understanding, which I think in tourism research has been overlooked. But I think again, from a practitioner perspective, of course, it makes a huge difference whether you have a stable internet connection or whether you're able to get the produce that you ordered or that you can get.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Like,
right?
especially yeah. nowadays, no, when like
yes yeah. and how does you know, like a virus interfere,
or
a vaccine
vaccine, virus, whatever, yeah, mm-hmm. the game changers, no, that no one expected them yeah. to kind of appear or yeah. become so such a determinant factor of our, let's say, business environment.
And if I can just add one thing, what's interesting with this is that often then when we start to look at tourism and follow the procedure that I was saying, what you often end up with is finding yourself outside of what we traditionally see as tourism, right? Mm-hmm. So just to give, like, often, like, let's talk about over-tourism that we spoke so much about just a few years back.
Yeah.
So when you were looking at over-tourism, there was this, oh, it's the tourists, right? Let's look at all these tourists in these streets. Or let's look at, so we were looking at tourism, and but the idea is that that's the symptom. So if you follow the actors, you see that it's also about other things, about just wages, about, you know, policies that, about housing, something about planning and governance of cruise tourism, but also, you know, harbor management and other kinds of investments in the city. So you're actually also finding yourself outside of, you know, tourism proper. And I think that's another thing that this kind of following the actor methodology allows you to see, that it might start with tourism, but very often tourism troubles are often a symptom of things that are troubled elsewhere.
That are happening. Exactly. I mean, it's a very interesting case that would just support like this notion of yours. Is like we've researched the urban development in Ljubljana and so on, and the voices, trying to analyze the voices surrounding the tourism. No, and last few years it was all about that it's Airbnb's fault that the real estate market is going up. No.
Mm.
That the prices are becoming like insane, and that the young families can no longer afford to live in the city. Then comes COVID. You no longer can rent over Airbnb to anyone because there are simply no tourists. What happens? The prices of real estate market keep on rising.
So
the problem must be somewhere else, not in Airbnb.
Yeah, exactly what we're seeing here. Yeah. So that's so interesting. And I think maybe... that COVID-19 actually gives us, I think, as tourism researchers and policymakers and practitioners, this opportunity to have this what if, like to imagine. And of course, before it's been purely speculative, but now we actually have almost like a playground or
exactly. It's an experiment. It's a live experiment, no?
Yes. Yeah,
before intervention, after intervention, and measuring. Yeah,
an open laboratory where you can play out these what ifs. And so we were looking at the tourists, pointing our fingers and saying they are to blame, but actually finding out that, oops, when they're not there, we're not finding ourselves in an ideal situation either, right? So maybe we need to understand, again, as I was saying, tourism as not only sort of self-explanatory. Tourism is deeply related to other spheres of the social, and to understand tourism, we also need to look elsewhere.
Which would be the industries you would hint at, or like the sectors that you would say are the most impactful when it comes to tourism? If you would need to point out in, let's say, three different directions, which sectors you think are the ones that have the most impact on what we see then that is going on in tourism?
Well, I think that probably depends. I think that's another thing we need to be mindful of, not trying to create models or one size fits all explanations for all tourism. I think that because tourism is embedded or closely related to the social, we need to look at the social as it unfolds differently in different locales. And so I think it can be in some areas, I think that the way, like just to take my own town as an example, I think that tourism and the way that urban planning is developed is very tightly connected. It also relates very closely to I think events and the cultural scene. also issues about hotels and restaurants. And so you have all these interconnected sectors or activities or areas of governance where tourism plays a part. And in some areas, it does so sort of under the radar, that as a tourism researcher, you can see it, but you don't see it in the policies. In others, it's more now, fortunately, explicitly incorporated into policies, for instance, like how tourism should not come as an afterthought when mm-hmm. developing a neighborhood, for instance, but should be thought in to begin with as a part of developing the urban more generally.
Mm-hmm. And you all already hinted that we shouldn't find the models that fit it all, no? I assume now you are working closely with the Arctic tourism development. Mm-hmm. Are there big differences between like the understanding of tourism in the, let's say, Denmark, like the southern Denmark, if we call it like this, no? Like the Copenhagen or the Jutland, and then the real Arctic Circle?
Yes. So looking at how tourism is currently evolving in Greenland, which is the focus area that I have, is so interesting because, again, it relates to areas that are far outside of tourism. Like the conversation going on in Greenland at the moment is how Greenland can become totally independent from the Commonwealth. Of Denmark. So actually, now that Greenland has self-rule, but how can they go from being self-ruled to becoming an independent nation state?
Yeah.
And in that move, tourism becomes a very useful tool. It's a strong discourse that the economy should, and not only discourse, it's a fact, right, that the economy needs to be developed to make this independence happening. And tourism is pointed to as, you know, one of these economic tools. So that is very interesting to see that tourism has such a big role in this. Also because, as everyone knows, the Arctic is of increasing geopolitical interest, and that there is just a general growing awareness about the Arctic as melting, because we're seeing climate changes so much more in this fragile environment. So you have, you know, high politics or geopolitics. You have climate change at the fore, and then you have this kind of indigenous movement towards independence. And in the middle of this, you have tourism, right? So as a tourism researcher, it's so interesting to see all of these discussions tie in to tourism development, and also because they obviously don't all fit. Like how do you work with sustainable tourism development in this frail Arctic environment, developing new international airports and getting ready to receive just a lot of tourists to grow the economy, right?
Well, yeah, you don't want to turn them into next Balearic Islands, no, probably.
No, but but I mean, some people are, some people, I really want to be very mindful of not pointing fingers. But I think maybe it ties into, you know, the ongoing discussion of what is sustainability.
Yeah.
That in this area, it's so obvious that, you know, environmental sustainability, economic sustainability, and social sustainability go in each their direction. Yeah. I mean, in some of the scenarios for where this is going. And that is, you know, academically super interesting, but I think practically also just a bit, you know.
You can't develop, I mean, without destroying one, you won't be really successful in another. No, I mean, you should, being aware of how ideal scenarios should be doesn't really help us in developing proper tourism on the ground. No,
And so it comes to something that I really cherish, this the idea of balancing,
yeah,
right? That how do we balance? Like, how do we, you know, in the real world, we can often not, you know, just choose between models or scenarios. Even though we might want to go in one direction, there are, you know, maybe from an ethical perspective, there are also other obligations, things that we need to do and need to care for. For instance, that Greenland wants independence from Greenland. And as a Danish researcher, I'm very mindful of not, you know, standing in a corner and saying, you know, you really shouldn't do this. You really shouldn't develop tourism, you know, for the sake of the environment. But, you know, people want their independence. And I think that's just fair. So how do you balance? How do you balance many things that you would like to do? And I think tourism is also a great platform to study that and to see how all different actors balance, you know, I mean, I think most many actors are not only driven by economic ideas, that they also have, you know, ideas about their communities, about, you know, the future of their children, you know, that there are many things that we would like to do. And how do you balance that in developing, in, you know, sustainable tourism?
From multiple perspectives, sustainable. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and not just textbook sustainable, exactly.
I'm also interested, how does then Greenland market itself as a destination? I mean, if you don't want to encourage so many tourists, but of course you want quality like every other destination, boutique tourism. So what is then the strategy?
And I think, again, there are actually, well, there's not multiple strategies. There's one strategy, I mean, at least one official strategy, which is to focus on the adventure. I mean, it's strictly adventure tourism based, and also to market sustainable tourism. So that's what's being marketed. But if we tend to, like, what else is happening? We right now have a huge infrastructure development project in the capital city of Nuuk, and the, you could say, tourism capital of Ilulissat. Right now, they do not have international airports, which means that you have to travel to a hub in Greenland and sort of get distributed to smaller aircrafts. But from 2023, you will be able to fly directly to Nuuk and to Ilulissat. And so, of course, this is a major investment for, you know, a population of 56,000 people. Which means that you will have to create some kind of massive revenue to pay off, you know, that investment. So on one hand, you have, you know, we want to have kind of not boutique. I think it's still, but I mean, it's expensive to travel to Greenland, that you want to have, you know, some clients or some tourists that can pay for a good experience in sustainable tourism. And on the other hand, you're investing yourself into a trajectory, which, to in my view, I mean, in order to make this a viable investment, you'll need to attract a hell of a lot of tourists. So again, you know, multiple realities here. One which is set for, you know, more niche, more kind of alternative tourism, more sustainable tourism, and another one which lends itself quite explicitly, at least if we look at, you know, the tarmac, the numbers, to mass tourism.
Connected to that, no? Often I've seen, since I follow you on social media and all the modern communication channels, often I've come across of you mentioning culturally sensitive tourism for the Arctic.
Yeah.
What would that be in your very own personal interpretation? I mean,
I think the reason why I'm mentioning this so often is that I'm part of a EU-funded project, Northern Periphery Arctic Program, which has funded the Arctisen, which is a project that works with developing culturally sensitive tourism in the Arctic. So it's an interesting project because it tries to look at how small businesses across the Arctic, so in Arctic Finland, Norway, Sweden, and Arctic Canada and Greenland work with developing their project products and experiences and how they market them. And what's been so interesting is how, even though you might say that these are similar in the sense that they're Arctic, we can see that the weight that especially indigenous entrepreneurs that we've been working with, so Sami entrepreneurs in Nordic Arctic, they have a very strong sense of a need to develop culturally sensitive stories, culturally sensitive products. And that in Greenland, because the situation is different from a historical perspective and political perspective, there just isn't that much focus on that. So it's been interesting to see that culture means, well, obviously, right? Culture means different things to different people.
People, yeah.
And plays out differently, even in situations that we might think of as similar. But having said that, I think that the Sami businesses that we took to Greenland, in December 19, so just before we closed the world down, and these Inuit or Greenlandic tourism businesses had a lot to learn from one another. And I think it's a lesson that many might that it might resonate with many about how the everyday and the stories and the practices that we can show how we work, how we are in nature, how we eat, how we interact in our everyday lives is just of real interest to others. And that culture does not need to be staged with costumes and the cultural props. In many cases, showing, how you live your life, how you go in nature, how you go out and enjoy yourself, or showing that experience is just to many a very valuable experience. And I think that goes maybe also to the whole Tourism from Zero initiative of how do we get back to basics? How do we not need to have massive system of this and that, but how can we go back to simple core stories about who we are, what the good life is to us, and share that.
Share that and make it attractive, make it appealing for the market as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, I'm not saying anything goes. Here's my laundry, right? I mean, come and share it. obviously, it has to be packaged and carefully selected. But I think that maybe scraping off that layer of the exotic, I mean, the layer of exotification is needed, and to actually go back to this idea that I think something we've also experienced here during COVID that actually we don't need to go very far. We really don't need to go so far outside of our comfort zone, or we don't need to travel to Bali or to South America, I don't know, to find something that's truly exotic, if you will, something that's truly different and that can amaze us or teach us something or something that's magical. And very often it does resort to how people live their lives just in different ways, very close to us, in fact.
Yeah, I think that this is one of the learning, let's say, outcomes of the first COVID summer, that you can have fun and good times and also meaningful experiences within the range of like 300 kilometers from your home. No?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you can change your everyday life significantly. It's not that you can't, just going to a neighboring region.
Yeah, and of course, I hear you saying that first summer, right? Because the question is, once everything is kind of back to normal, or when the borders open up and we gain, regain our, the privileged parts of the world, regain their kind of access to hypermobility, yeah. will we just go back to that, or will we keep some of these experiences with us for microtourism or nearcation?
And nearcation, that's a nice one. We don't use it often.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, it's big. It's been a big thing here in Denmark, where what was done last summer was to give big discounts to railways and to ferries. So Denmark has a lot of inhabited islands. To enable people to rediscover the country. And so what we saw was that in the coastal areas and sort of the rural areas, many destinations and businesses had, you know, the summer of their lives because they were both able to welcome Danish tourists that came for the first time and the kind of the usual tourists from Germany, Norway, the Netherlands, etc. So that was really interesting to see. That development, and then looking at, you know, the urban areas like Copenhagen that had a drastic fall in visitation because it has been focusing on attracting farm markets, right? So the whole Asian market disappeared, North American, etc. Yeah,
and big conventions and like incentives, no things that are not happening at the moment.
Yes.
We had very similar story in Slovenia. Basically, mm-hmm. countryside, at least in summer, when they were able to be open, no, outperformed previous seasons. Okay, financially not, but in terms of generating the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
The countryside, like the lakes, the mountains, the seaside, it was
packed. Yeah.
But the big cities like Ljubljana, Maribor, and like the main like Bled, which every Asian needs to see when he's in this part of the world, no?
Yeah.
And take the photographs, that those were empty. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, will we get back to normal, or is there some learnings to draw from this? And again, I think it's a balance. I don't think it's an either or. I'm pretty positive that people are not globally going, you know, in a vacation mode. But I think still that there are things to be learned both as a consumer, like that you've been I don't want to, you know, say mm-hmm. everyone, but many of us have kind of discovered the pleasure and the experiences with staying close, or, you know, maybe also slowing down your travels, walking and hiking and taking a boat or a train. Yes. Oh, I think I lost my thread here.
Not spending every prolonged weekend abroad, no? And
yes.
flying somewhere.
Yeah. So finding that balance, right, between hypermobility and micromobility. I think that would be a good start to find a better balance in mobility, because, I mean, none of us want to not travel. And I, as I've seen others talk about, you know, just like with our food and maybe our clothing increasingly, to once we're over this, you know, the experience of just mass consumption, to mm-hmm. think about less is better, like quantity or quality over quantity. Can we think about that more in our travels? Maybe take less travels, but maybe once you go, you stay there longer. And experience the destination more in depth.
You properly disconnect, not just continue checking your emails.
yes, and you also don't crowd the city center, right? If you're at the destination for 2 weeks, I mean, you will still be giving, you know, 14 bed nights, but you will not be spending them all, you know, in the crowded areas. You'll be going more to, you know, to the neighborhood, so you'll be taking trips outside of the city. So developing more sensitive tourism patterns. Yeah.
Mm. Dispersed tourism, like not going just to the centers, yes, and really giving a chance also for other destinations, like especially in Slovenia. We just had, you see an increase people going to the eastern side of Slovenia, not just, you know, to the more known western parts. So it's a really a nice trend.
Yes. And I think this is a concern to many who have wondered, like, we still want to have more visitors, but we want to spread it out. So we want to spread it out, you know, with the seasons. So it's not so, like on the shoulders and ideally year round. But also we would like to not only to take place in specific sites, but to spread it out more to many, many places. And I think that's also a global trend, if you will, to think about how to more sustainably develop the infrastructure
just everything in one place.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, I'm aware that others criticize that, saying, you know, sometimes it's a good idea to work a little bit with these tourist camps so that you don't have tourists everywhere. I disagree. I think it's about, thinking, finding more, you know, ways to tread more lightly. And maybe also to work with this, you know, them and us, the tourists. I mean, taking in that we're all tourists and we're all locals. How do we develop more sensitive encounters also?
But also we're not just having like just tourists and just locals. We also have tourists that are turning locals for like 6 months that are going to work there like digital nomads. So they really want to be like locals, not just the tourists. So it's really this is also an interesting trend coming up, especially with young people.
Yeah.
And myself as well. We don't want
our
to be
aspiring
patient,
digital nomad Rudy. Probably kicked in just a few months too early before he managed to escape.
Well, you know what? I mean, in January, the plan is to take my family to Tromsø in the north of Norway and stay there for 6 months. We had envisioned to go there this January, but then of course the plans changed. So I think we all have some kind of not necessarily all of us, but many of us have this aspiration to go local somewhere else as a way of also traveling. And I think it ties into this that you're kind of pointing at, like what is this relationship between, you know, the visitor and the guest, or the local and the tourist? And I think, does it make sense? Like, are these, you know, terms that apply in a useful way anymore? Because of all these many, many different ways of traveling and moving for leisure and for work and everything in between. Maybe looking more at like how do visitors localize or distance themselves in relation to a visited destination. I think these are interesting thoughts. Like in relation to how we make these more sensitive treading when visiting places.
When are you actually a tourist then? Even if I go 20 kilometers from my house, I can feel like a visitor or a tourist. So it's really a blurred line between being a tourist and the local, let's say.
Yes, and I think like last year where we were locked down, my family and I went, I don't know, like 2 kilometers into the inner city and spent 2 days at a hotel. So really, I mean, and, you know, staying in the pool and going to Tivoli and, you know, walking
enjoying
down the
the different Copenhagen.
And so I think that, again, I think that ties in also to the theories that we were talking about, not working in binaries and distinctions that I think are maybe not so productive. Like, yes, if you want to count stuff, you know, a bed night or, you know, but the problem is, of course, that, you know, next to that, we also allude to certain ways of being that also this, you know, this often negative connotation to the tourist. Like, who wants to be the tourist? Everybody wants to be the traveler.
Exactly. And
I think maybe, and also as our cities and our rural areas increasingly become places of their work, places of work, of leisure, but also, like you're saying, this micro tourism, that we go somewhere, you know, to a festival or to an event or to a museum, or and we all of these, the practices are touristic, or they blur, right? So what's the point of making these distinctions? What do they serve other than creating this us and them and pointing fingers? And I think, you know, in a world where we are making, I think, too many distinctions between us and them, tourism can maybe, I don't know, step forward and show how we can engage in other types of encounters that are not only based on us and them.
Us and them, yeah, the distinction. So plans for this season, Karina. Okay, we've heard from January on sort of sabbatical, no, in Norway. What about the summer? I mean, this problematic summer that no one knows how it's going to look like, even though it's knocking on the doors.
Yeah.
Any specific plans and how this will like be different from your usual traveling summer vacation mode?
Yeah. Well, I can share the secret, you know, that it's easier to be a tourism researcher talking about sustainable tourism when you don't really like flying. Like, I'd much rather, you know, go by train or by car or by boat, so that's the plan. We have also I think as I get older, also really like to just not stay too far. We have a summer cottage a cottage in Sweden, in the forest, a few hours from here, across the bridge to Sweden, where we spend weekends. Well, now we haven't been able to go for a very long time, but now we're back. So that's where I like to stay, you know, offline and relax, look into the forest and the lakes. And then also spending time with my in-laws in Jutland at a, you know, super tourist destination by the sea. and then maybe driving to Italy. Let's see. That was the plan last year, northern Italy, and we cancelled. And now we're seeing if maybe we can go.
You can go, and then you can stop in Ljubljana for a coffee on the way.
Oh, sounds fantastic.
No, that's good. Good. Yeah, Rudy, I think you have your final question ready, don't you? One hour has passed.
Two questions.
Yeah. Two final questions. Yeah.
So nothing scary, Karina. you work a lot, of course, with students, with young people starting out in the tourism industry, let's say. And I was wondering if you have any advice for young people starting in tourism, even if there is a more negative, dark situation in tourism, employment or things related to tourism, but still, do you have any encouraging advice?
Well, I think, it looks bleak at the moment. And I think maybe similar to what I've been talking about all along through this conversation about how tourism relates closely to other spheres of the social. I think that the tools and the competences that we offer our students on our master program is something that they can also take elsewhere. When we talk about, it can be hands-on skills or, you know, sort of, you know, what with marketing and knowledge about consumers, but also more broadly about different kinds of encounters, different ways of analyzing places as destinations, and also more generally about sustainable development and policymaking and so on. I think that what we give our students as tools, I mean, they can take that elsewhere. It's not something that's limited to working on a on a within a tourism business or a, you know, a place as a destination. I think that this travels elsewhere, and I can see that, you know, when I'm on that social media LinkedIn, I can see that my students go in many other places that what you would think. So hopefully also with the experiences that they have in the internships and so on, they become creative and innovative and entrepreneurial in making, just like I do, like taking tourism in all sorts of directions, and not thinking that you are set for one role or for one specific job. And I think especially, of course, in times of crisis, this is something that's really valuable. That you take the skills and the competences that we teach you and make them your own and turn them into something that you're passionate about, something that you want to do.
Great. That's really just exactly the debate we had in our community the other day. What is really, I mean, how has COVID encouraged some other, employment opportunities for tourism creators, like you said? You are a creator and you can create in a destination or in a hotel or like anywhere. I mean, there's really a lot of possibilities.
Yes. And I think that's what I'm seeing with students. Like they take it in different kinds of directions. I'm seeing within teaching or consulting or working with digital applications or different kinds of events, often online. So our graduates, I think, are quite ingenious. Of course, maybe also unfortunately because they're forced to, but to take their skills and apply them in other contexts. And I think that again to bridge that the borders between tourism and everything else. I think that's also a really good thing to see.
That's great to hear. I would like to ask just the final question, which of course you know already, and it's part of the Tourism from Zero initiative, and we would like to hear your thoughts, your views, your ideas on how to restart tourism from point zero.
Well, I think that it was never zero, if you don't mind me saying it.
Of course.
I want to maybe challenge this idea that it was from zero. I mean, what we've seen in Denmark and also like from Greenland, like in these places that are quite different, but in both places we've seen this working with the near-cation concept, like how do we get locals to support tourism businesses, like go on trips, go on hikes, partake in things in nature, do things digitally, like in different ways support tourism. So already from there, I think that it was never zero, because there was this this support system, and I also think these innovative initiatives, like how can we use, for instance, hotels in different ways, you know, providing lodging for students, providing lodging for people that are, I don't know, divorced or remaking their homes, as everybody seemed to be during COVID. How can we open up the hotels or the restaurants, take out pop up things out in the open? So how can we work with changing our businesses that previously was directly marketed to tourists and market it and develop it further to cater for locals? So I think of course that's not enough if you're based on a huge intake of tourists, but I think that just seeing this, that you can actually change your business and you can direct yourself to other markets and provide experiences to other kinds of customers. I think that's a way to restart or to rethink and maybe in a more a more sustainable way.
So if we sum it up again, if COVID is going to give us a new lesson on sustainable innovation in Chile, won't
it? Yeah. I think so. And I think also, again, maybe this balancing that before, at least, I mean, yeah, in many destinations, your business models were built around, you know, farm markets, people that came by airplane from far away. Like these were some of the markets that you were targeting. I'm not naive, and I'm not thinking that is going to disappear after COVID. But I hope, and I think also, that the experiences we've had with the near-cation markets, the local markets, or the domestic markets, and the near markets will also open our eyes to a more sustainable and less CO2 consuming or emission driven industry, where hypermobility is supplemented with micromobility. I think that this is something that we will see. It also makes, you know, the economy less more robust, right? Yeah, so should this happen again?
That would be, I would say, so that would be the optimum scenario, no? And like, let's say optimum / realistic one.
Yes, so it's not the blue-eyed, you know, from now on, we'll all just walk to on holiday.
Yeah, exactly.
No, and we shouldn't, right? We need to hang on to the fact that it should be a right for everyone. And so far, it's just still such a tiny little, you know, part of the globe that has access to air flight. And I don't think that as such should be a human right. But I think learning and experiencing things, I mean, as you do when you travel, I mean, that is something that should be for everyone. So finding that balance, I think balancing it is a realistic hope for the recovery.
Yeah, in a more responsible way.
Yeah, let's hope so.
Let's hope so, yeah. Fingers crossed.
Definitely. Yes.
So finding balance, innovating, and being responsible, let's say, are the our guidelines, the ERT guidelines for the COVID recovery.
Very soon.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Tourism from Zero podcast. If you like our show, you can subscribe in your podcast application or follow us on social media. You're also welcome to join our community, Ideas from Zero, for more interesting content about tourism.